Hello and welcome to the ALC Pan-African Radio's Talking Africa program. Talking Africa provides in-depth interviews with experts and other actors in the field of peace and security in Africa.
Bringing together over 40 academics and policy practitioners from around the world, the Africa Leadership Center, in collaboration with Social Science Research Council, held a conference in Wilton Park just outside London earlier this year. The conference focused on peace building in Africa. It aimed, among other things, to examine the evolving challenges in the field, responses, and what new thinking is emanating from the terrain. For Talking Africa, my colleague Desmond Davis spoke to Aboubakar Zain, member of the East African Legislative Assembly, which is the legislative arm of the East African community, and began by asking him how he viewed the conflicts in the region today.
Welcome to Talking Africa. I am Desmond Davis. My guest today is Aboubakar Zain, a member of the East African Legislative Assembly, the legislative arm of the East African community. As a former chairperson of the Regional Affairs and Conflict Resolution Committee of the East African Legislative Assembly, how do you view the conflict in your region?
Thank you very much for inviting me to this great program. We have had the challenges in the past. We see potential for challenges in the future. So the region is grappling with the fact of being in a location in Africa, which is got conflict going on. On one side, Somalia, you know that both Somalia and Southern Sudan have applied to join the East African community.
Yes.
But both those countries are facing security challenges, and there is conflict there. We also border the DRC. Tanzania borders DRC, Burundi, Rwanda, and there's been a lot of challenges in relation to security and the ongoing conflict for a long time in DRC. Apart from our neighbors, we also had problems, the genocide in Rwanda, the civil conflict in Burundi, the post-election crisis in Kenya. We've also had election-related, limited breaches of security and peace in Zanzibar, in Uganda, and so on. Now, that is a broad look at some of those things.
Yeah, so I mean, this is one reason why there's a need to strengthen the East African standby force to deal with these issues, because I don't think any single country can handle these problems, do you think?
No, you're completely right that we cannot ensure the peace, stability, progress in the region without the participation of all countries and everyone. And that calls to us to establish an institutional framework for handling peace and security. And you know that within the East African community, we have draft defense protocol, which now I think two countries have signed. You need to have all the five signed so that they can come into effect. But also we have a peace and security protocol, which is part of the African peace and security architecture. And we are hoping that once we have both those instruments in place, they will give us an institutional framework to be able to handle issues of security, including the question of the standby force. What is important also to bear in mind is that if you go by the current framework, you then have a situation where some members of the East African community are in the East African standby force, but Tanzania would be in the Southern standby force.
Yes.
And what the community instruments does is then to establish a framework where the community would have a standby force for the community. And this is important because as we speak now, you have Kenya, Burundi, Uganda, in Somalia, but not as an East African community framework, but as an AU, UN framework.
Well, that's the point, you see, because, I mean, it seems as if we're having too many regional peace and security architectures. Why don't this country go back and strengthen the East African Standby Force? Because there's already a schism, people are saying, between the East African Standby Force and these regional bodies you're talking about.
Yes, that's what I'm saying, that for me, it's not a matter of strengthening the East African Standby Force. For me, it's to strengthen the community framework. Once you have strengthened community framework, then we could merge the East African Standby Force with the community framework. That will mean all members of the community are in one place, as opposed to some members are in a different one and some members are...
So that's the way you see it going, because others are saying that the community force was really established because Kenya, in the East African Standby Force, didn't have a say in it, because, I mean, there were bigger neighbors who were dominating Kenya. That was the reason why maybe Kenya then pushed for this community standby force.
No. I think the defense protocol draft defense protocol predates... The negotiations for that predates the establishment of the East African Standby Force.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So if you want to clarify chicken and egg, I'll say that the community conceptualization came before
the Standby Force.
The Standby Force. Mm-hmm. But already, what I agree with what the premise of the question you've given me is that we need to have a harmonized way of creating. Working relationships and sharing of mandates between different regional integration communities, different international actors, and where there is overlaps, there should be a framework of managing the overlaps.
Mm. I mean, do you think, I mean, that the African Union is up to the challenge of dealing with the conflicts in Africa?
Absolutely. We have teething problems. We have not completed put in place the necessary ingredients to fully activate the African peace and security architecture. We also need to complement the African peace and security architecture as it stands today with the participation of communities and peoples. Because at the moment, it's very much intergovernmental. It's very much established state institutions, and very little is said about the participation of civil society, the participation of faith-based communities, the participation of other actors and players who are important in the project of making sure that peace and stability thrives in Africa.
Yeah, but it is 13 years now since the launch of the AU, and that is what the AU stressed. I mean, peace and security in Africa and human security. Why is it taking the AU such a long time to meet this its basic requirement?
I think partly it's because of the paradigm shift from the OAU to the AU. Partly that, but also partly that they requires a lot of consensus building within the framework of the AU and painstaking negotiations for every step that you make and you want to work with people. That's another reason. But also, let it be said that there are elements that deal with the question of peace and security in Africa that a number of regimes and countries within the African community, the African continent, are reluctant to get into, talking about governance, democracy,
yes.
Free, fair, credible and peaceful elections and related matters. So part of that complications come from those, that there are some countries that do not want to abide by certain international standards and norms, and they do not see progress being made in the EU, in the African Union,
yes.
As AU, as something that is beneficial to them.
Yeah, but this is the point. I mean, the African leaders are more interested in fighting the ICC and trying to establish its own their own court, rather than dealing with the problems in Africa of impunity still there and human rights violations. I mean, you know.
I think there are three things that are related to what you've just asked. The first one is that African countries, many of the African countries that are signatories to the ICC, the state parties, the ICC, were not forced by anybody.
Indeed.
They willingly signed and ratified the ICC framework, and I don't know what moved them to do it. But if it was truly based on the need and necessity of addressing impunity, then they should not be complaining about how the ICC is working. And if there are issues with the ICC, you should be working to strengthen the teething problems of ICC and whatever else needs that to be handled. The second element you are referring to is, I think that if there are people who think that in order to continue with impunity, then you come up with a whitewash African framework, I don't think that will do. It will not be able to satisfy anybody, not even citizens from those states that think like that. And the last point, I think, which is critical, is we as Africans have developed very many policies and very many frameworks, including protocols, the AU, the cultural protocol is a good example. Mm-hmm. The protocol on good governance, democracy and elections, and many others. Now, those are crying out to be implemented before we can even start talking about new frameworks and new instruments. We need to do well and implement those instruments that already exist and improve on them. So for me, it is not a good argument to say that we can have a different kind of justice for Africa from the rest of the world.
Exactly.
We could have different approaches. And you could say that our approach to justice is more holistic or more comprehensive and is less punitive, but more of reconciliation and so on. But even that is not being practiced in Africa.
You are listening to Talking Africa on the ALC Pan-African Radio. Stay tuned.
To a certain extent, one must listen to what the African leaders are saying. Because, you see, when it comes to Africa, it's selective justice, and justice also is not really seen to be done. Because let's face it, where are the defense witnesses going to come from Africa? Where are the prosecution witnesses going to come from Africa? But will they be allowed to go to The Hague to give evidence? So these are the issues we should look at, because there have been talk that if that's the case, let them move the ICC headquarters to Arusha.
There are two issues that that question raises for me. Mm-hmm. The first one is the limitations of the international justice system.
Yes.
And if you start from the Rwanda Tribunal as a starting place of any lessons that we've learned, is that it has very many limitations. Now, if you compare the Gacaca process and the Rwanda Tribunal process, you can't compare. Mm. The one dealt with 50 cases and billions of dollars, and the other one has done more than 200,000 cases with a fraction of the cost that that was used in the tribunal. And on the other hand, the other one used indigenous methods that also included reconciliation and healing and forgiveness. But the other one is much more punitive in the sense of people being jailed. And the victims and survivors don't have a lot of, apart from being involved in the sentencing as witnesses and in the sentencing press phase or penalty phase, if you like, nothing else is done in that framework. So what it means that we as Africans must talk more about what lessons can we bring in either strengthening in the international justice system or coming up with institutions that work and are believable and credible. Mm-hmm. But the second point that is also critical for us in this matter is for how long, and I agree with those who believe in the question of African solutions to African problems. Given, if you give the context that we understand our situation and context better than anybody else, and we are seeking real solutions to our problems informed by our lived life. But if it means that you are using this as an argument for impunity, I don't think anybody will buy that.
But the entrenched situation in African societies that are difficult to resolve, you see, and that is where we have a problem. You know, people are so set in their ways that even trying to come up with an African solution still will create problems. I'm talking about the ethnic divide.
That's what I'm talking about also well. Mm. I think we have a lot more in common than we have in differences. Yes. But I think we need to bring to the fore the positive elements and also counter the negative elements. I have a cultural background and I believe that there's a lot of value in us looking into our cultures and finding those things that worked. But it also important to admit that there are certain harmful cultural practices that we have to deal away with.
Yes.
But also more importantly for me is how we define ourselves and how we define the different communities that live among each other, and coming up with a social justice framework that allows for participation and inclusion rather than division. And in all this, I think we have not paid enough attention to the question of the role of leadership.
Yes.
We've had challenges in terms of what leadership is in Africa. And once leaders get into power, there is a clear difference between what they were promising before coming to power and coming into power. So there is also need for us to look at our accountability mechanisms and hold each other accountable for what we say and what we do.
But do you believe that, or do you think that there's been a resolution of the post-election violence in Kenya? Or are there still underlying issues?
There are many challenges in Kenya as far as the post-election challenges and crisis that people identified. Let me start with the first one. Even before that violence, people had seen the signs that it is possible to go that way. And if you look at the Constitution of Kenya Review Commission report, it clearly identified that that scenario is possible given the fault line that existed within the Kenyan context and history. If you look at the African Peer Review report, the first one on Kenya, it also said the same thing. So it wasn't for lack of telltale signs and warning signs that were there, but I think it was the reluctance of status quo to accept that change and radical transformative change is required. And you would recall that this violence came within the context of a failed referendum to adopt a new constitution, which was supposed to be transformative in nature. Now, that crisis, I think, propelled us to accept the 2010 Constitution. Mm. The 2010 Constitution is a very good framework to address some of the key challenges that we face in Kenya today and in the past, but it has its own challenges. And the major challenge that comes to the fore is implementing that constitution without its transformative nature. That's number one. Number two, that you could tell from the 2013 elections that we have not gotten over some of the challenges that we still had in 2007, 2008. And to make matters worse, when we were approaching the 2013 elections, there were two important developments in Kenya that ensured that the 2013 elections were peaceful. Mm. They were not credible, in my opinion, but they were peaceful, with very little reportage of little violence.
Violent, yes.
That, number one, was the creation of the Supreme Court as a mechanism of managing post-election disputes. And number two, the confidence that the electoral management body had. Now, by the time we were approaching the 2013 elections, the confidence ratings of that commission was about 85%. Now, as we speak, the same commission has about 35% confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So we are saddled with a situation where within 2.5 years, an electoral management body has completely lost its confidence.
Yes.
On the question of the Supreme Court, its mismanagement of the presidential dispute makes it very difficult for a loser in the coming elections to go back to the Supreme Court to seek justice.
Mm-hmm.
So between now and when we have the next elections, it is absolutely critical for us to revisit some of those issues. Further, there is a question and a dangerous phenomena that has started growing in Kenya, and people call it the tyranny of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And this relates to the winner-take-all mentality that is common in most African countries. And for me, I don't want any type of tyranny, numbers or on any basis. And until and unless we are able to address the question of electoral reform, as even now as we speak, because the commission of which I had the honor to serve in,
yes,
had proposed a mixed member proportional representation,
mm-hmm,
and move away from the first past the post majoritarian electoral system. But in the end, the politicians are the ones who insisted on maintaining the first past the post system. Now, until and unless we start addressing those issues, it will be very, very difficult not to have electoral disputes, because the stakes involved in the outcome of the elections and who becomes president is very, very high. Lastly, it's the question of the devolved system of government that we are implementing in Kenya today. And we are not doing it with fidelity, and we are using one level of government. The constitution establishes two levels of government that are distinct but cooperate between each other. But we're using the National Assembly, for instance, to take away the powers, add what is rightfully to the devolved government. Mm-hmm. And you've seen a number of laws that the National Assembly has passed being invalidated by the Constitutional Court as being unconstitutional. The most recent one is on the Constituency Development Fund. So until we address holistically the question of how faithfully and with what form of fidelity are we implementing the Constitution, the coming elections will have problems.
So what all this boils down to, not just in Kenya, but in Africa, is a failure of governance.
True.
Complete failure of governance.
It is
and that's but the fault of the elite.
But also for me, yes, and that's where I was going. When you say failure of governance, large part
nothing
of it is leadership.
Yes, leadership.
It's leadership.
Yes.
Poor leadership, partisan leadership,
yes,
ethnic-driven leadership,
yes,
that seeks to exclude. If you win elections, then it means for the next 5 years you are in power. Everybody else is excluded,
yeah,
except you and the few people around you,
yes,
and those who you please,
yes,
or based on whatever fault lines, mm-hmm, you want to identify.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's self-perpetuating, because after those 5 years, you start wanting another term,
mm-hmm,
and another term.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right that governance is an important aspect of this, and failure of governance in Africa.
Abubakar Zain, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Abubakar Zain, member of the East African Legislative Assembly, talking to Desmond Davis for Talking Africa.
Thank you for listening to Talking Africa and ALC Pan-African Radio. For these and other programs, please visit our website at alcpanafricanradio.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Radio ALC and on Facebook at African Leadership Center. For feedback on this and other programs, please send an email to info@africanradio.com.